This episode of the Flush Podcast is brought to you by Aluma Trailers, ReadyRest, Walton's, Hi-Viz Shooting Systems, Hoxie Native Seeds, and by Onyx Hunt. My guests today are Adam Nelson and Evan Curtin from the nonprofit organization called Hunters for Access. We'll discuss their mission to help all of us gain more access to hunting land, which, of course, is one of the biggest challenges we face today. We'll also find out how and why they are growing and what they've learned since Hunters for Access began. Welcome to another episode of the Flush Podcast. I'm Travis Frank. I am your host on this weekly bird hunting experience. Brandon Martin is our producer. Brandon, good to see you.
Nice to see you as well, Travis. I am doing great.
Yeah,
it's been a while, a couple weeks.
Your beard looks spectacular.
Well, thank you. I just trimmed it yesterday. You should have seen it before. It was massive.
Yeah. Well, we are nearing one of your favorite hunting seasons. Morel mushroom hunting.
Absolutely.
Season. You haven't found one yet, but I know it's only a matter of time.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I'm staking out areas in my free time as we speak.
What does that mean, staking them out?
Staking it out, looking for the proper trees, looking for good ground coverage, making sure the areas I normally go in aren't either too dry or flooded out so far this year.
Yeah.
Just little things like that, you know, going over the old spots, making sure they're still okay. Some of them might not be good this year. That's just kind of how it goes. But yeah.
What's been your best morel mushroom hunting season?
I would say last year and the year before were both really good seasons.
Really?
The year before was probably
one of my best. Is it because you're learning more about them?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's even just doing these shows with you and stuff. I've learned so much from, you know, instead of looking down the entire time, one of the biggest hints I got is look up.
Yeah.
Look at the trees that you're trying to aim for as opposed to looking down on the ground the entire time.
Right.
And also take risks. There's morels growing in spots that aren't by the book that they're supposed to be. You know, check a little bit further out from the patch that you found. There might be another one. So
it's also
yes, it is.
Go, 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 go. Turkey hunting season.
That's what I read.
Oh, yes. Oh, here, Daisy. Yeah, she heard the call. We just tried to call in a turkey outside the office here while we were waiting for this room to open up here with my guests today, Adam and Evan. I should do a proper introduction. Adam Nelson and Evan Curtin, you guys are from the nonprofit organization called Hunters for Access. We appreciate you making time to come in today. When we get out of this room, there's going to be a Tom Strutting.
Yeah, that's
there,
right. Guys. Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Before we jump into the conversation about Hunters for Access, I do want to read a listener question. And you both have a lot of dog experience here, so you can jump in too on this one. The question comes from Eric. I'm going to pronounce it Sissel. I've been listening to your podcast along with many others, and I've yet to hear the answer to my question. I'm adopting a Finnish dog. He will be about 1 year old, and he's a GSP. I currently have a Boykin Spaniel, and she's an incredibly athletic dog. I'm looking for ways to learn the new dog and build my relationship before this hunting season. I will have the dog in July. Hope you see this message and can help. Thanks for your input. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I thought I would read it and then we could discuss it on the show because there are people getting dogs all the time that aren't necessarily a puppy. I do think the answer to this question, there could be many answers to it, but spending time with that dog one-on-one, and that might mean leaving your Spaniel at home and taking just the GSP out. And really, I think going back to the basic foundation with that dog in training, that Spaniel is going to hunt differently than the GSP.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're talking a flusher and a pointer, you know. So I really think developing a relationship with that new dog is going to be different than when it's a puppy. And I say that because I have experience getting a dog that was 6.5 months old. She had a lot of her traits already established when I got her, all of her habits, and things changed when I brought her out of that environment that she grew up in and into my environment. So you're going to learn a few things about your new dog when you get that. Did he say if it was a rescue adopting? He said he's adopting a Finnish dog, and I'm not sure where that dog came from. Oh. And that's going to play a big part in acclimating to to your lifestyle, Eric, but really it's just spending time. Take that dog all kinds of places. You see right now I've got Daisy here, guys.
And, that's right.
And she is so acclimated to being around dogs. We have anywhere from 4 to 8 office dogs in our office at any given time. And so that's important. But she's also, you know, to follow the rules. You notice when we open the door, she doesn't just go running out, you know. So it's just the foundation is important, whether it's an 8-week-old puppy that you're bringing home or a 1-year-old puppy. You need to establish that pecking order, and that dog needs to know it's where it falls in line. Because if you don't become the leader, the pack leader for the new dog, then that dog will not understand its role, and therefore you're going to have issues. So establishing that right away is important. It's having fun with the dog, going out on runs, going out and taking the dog to swim, just doing all the things together, and your relationship will continue to grow. It'll be a process, but investing into that dog is just as important as 1-year-old as it is the day that you bring an 8-week-old puppy home. Anything to add to that, guys?
Well, I would say 1-year-old dog isn't exactly an older dog.
Right. Still a puppy.
Yeah. And I would, different people have a different idea of what a finished dog is. Circles I run, a 1-year-old some dog is not going to be a finished dog. Having said that, I would first try to work with the current owner and see what kind of commands are the commands that have been taught. You know, one person might have, you know, here versus come, drop versus out, you know, there's a variety of things. And then you can get frustrated as an owner, like, well, this is the command that I'm giving him, and why is he, she not doing it?
That's a great idea. When I leave Daisy somewhere, if I'm going to be away and can't bring the dog with, for example, every time I leave her at my dad's house, I literally write out the 8 words that's that he good. Needs to know, because otherwise he's going to be talking like, Dad, you don't need to say all this. Just 1 word, here, or whoa, or, you know, whatever it might be. And if he doesn't know it, he's guessing. And she's like, what are you doing? But exactly. It's helpful to know that. So I think if you're bringing a dog home, what has that dog already been taught? That's that's huge. If it's a finished dog, okay, what kind of training system were you training with this dog?
Yep.
That is important, because the dog trainers that are doing a great job are spending a lot of time training the trainer, not necessarily the dog.
That's
you
right.
as the owner need to know and understand that dog training system so you can keep it going. And eventually that dog will come in line and understand that you are, in fact, the leader of this pack. And then they'll know their role and they'll be a happy dog because of it.
That's right.
And I would almost even try to do some training with the current owner.
For sure.
You know, just that my dog listens to me. The breeder's wife, he doesn't listen to, but he'll listen to the breeder.
Yeah.
So kind of that translate, you know, having that person
there. I think they understand their role in the pack.
Yeah.
And sometimes they'll take on, I am the leader over some of these others.
Exactly.
That's right.
And that's what's interesting too. I have a little 2-year-old and she's already given Daisy orders.
Yeah. So. You got to start young they start filling that void. Yeah, absolutely.
So you're listening to the voice of Adam Nelson and Evan Curtin. Adam, you said the circles that I run in. What are those circles?
So I'm been doing NAVDA and I'm kind of getting away from that. And then the breed club. I have 2 French Brittany's. So the Epinole CBUSA is
Epinole Breton.
Yep.
Do you say that or do you say French Brittany?
I just say a French Brittany.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not.
You're not fancy?
No. I do make fun of, quote unquote, make fun of American Brittany owners. I had one on a walk the other day. What kind of dog is that? Oh, it's a French Brittany. Oh, I have Brittany's. I didn't realize what's a French Brittany. Oh, it's what created your dog.
Yeah,
is what they are. I don't know. So we do field trials with them.
How do you get into that and why? Why do you get into the trials?
Something to do off season. And then you can kind of have an idea of what you want to train for. Just, you know, I want this type of hunting dog. And then you can kind of burn yourself out on certain aspects of training. Or, you know, just over the hunting season, things slip. So it kind of just helps keep you on your toes and
right.
gives you something else to focus on. And
the dog for a lot of trainers going into opening day is probably going to be as tightened up
yeah.
as they'll be throughout the entire year, yep. because yep. towards the end of it, things yep. can yep. kind of get a little sloppy, yep. the dog and the handler.
Yep.
If yeah. we're being honest, you know, yep. some things might happen with the wild bird and you're trying to get that bird and things might slip. And
yep.
the spring training season seems to be when a lot of people are like, I hear that all the time. We're going to just tighten things up.
Yep.
We're going to bring things back to square one here. Mm-hmm. We're going to, you know, we're going to have that dog finished
yep.
again.
Yep.
Yep. You know?
And so, it's hard. You've been walking for 3 hours, haven't seen a bird. Your dog doesn't do the right thing. You're probably going to shoot at that bird. And it's, you know, well, now he doesn't have to do the right thing.
Right.
And it's just a precipitous decline the rest of the season.
Sure.
Yep.
Evan, you have a pup?
I have a 4-year-old wire here. It's my second one. I'm a NAVDA member. I don't really run trials much, but I really appreciate the community and learning because I've trained both my dogs myself and I'm the world's okayest trainer, you know, naturally. So having that community of people to kind of like, you know, correct me and have things to work on has been really helpful, but I haven't run anything other than, natural ability.
Myself. How do you two know each other?
We met a long time, for both this project and then, through a different one, Matt Ranella introduced us. Actually, we both know him pretty well.
Okay.
And so then, we're both the Minnesota guys. And so we've been focusing on this Hunters for Access opportunity to kind of work together. And it's been really great to we have a really great team here that's kind of all gotten to know each other well, but none of us have been able to hunt together yet. So this season, I'm hoping we'll be able to get out there real well. So.
Yeah, also the definitely. First time seeing face to face also.
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've been working.
You communicate, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've seen his face before on Zoom. That's it though. Yeah. So yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, if you weren't in Tanzania running around, maybe you'd right. see each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
What that was that like? What were you doing out there?
So my company has a field office there where we work with a hospital that's out in the middle of nowhere. And this hospital is just great. It's run by a priest. He's 93 years old. He still walks around, does all the work or like organizing everything. He's got a team, but like just a real dedicated guy, just a cool guy. And he's been there for 50 or 60 years. So he's from Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. So we talked all about these things, wow. you know, growing up, he's talking about local fishing spots, all these things.
Say talk walleyes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And farming and everything else. But he's lived in Tanzania for all this time. So we work really closely with his hospital and do some outreach to the villages that are around there. Some of them still don't have electricity, you know, some of them do. So it's really important to get that messaging out there because there's no other way to get it. So that's what we did.
So hands-on, you're in the field working with the people.
That's right.
You most likely talked hunting with some of the locals there. What was that like?
So it was difficult to hear. It sounded like a lot of people had hunting traditions that went back a long way that they're not able to do anymore at all. So they're.
What does that mean?
So it's illegal for people from Tanzania to hunt in Tanzania. Effectively, you have to have a government permit, and they're not open to resident applications at the moment. So if you're a Tanzanian citizen, you cannot hunt in Tanzania. But if you're an American citizen, I could get a permit to go hunting. I could get at these various game preserves, you can get one. And I know that it's well thought out. There's this African model of conservation, but personally, it really rubbed me the wrong way that there were people who were facing really harsh consequences, you know, when they're hungry to go out and they weren't able to hunt. And a lot of people had knowledge of it. A lot of people were doing it still. And I could tell it was something
they didn't want to talk about because.
Yeah. Yeah. And they were passionate about it. You could tell, you know, like they were, it was just like chatting with you or anyone uh-huh. else, like talking, you know, tactics and different things, but it was really guarded conversation because they knew, you know, we can't really talk about this very much. So.
Could you imagine if our government said, sorry guys, you can't hunt, only somebody from England can yeah. hunt here?
Right. Yeah. It would be devastating, and it was devastating for a lot of these folks. I mean, it wasn't only the tradition, which I think is part of it that's lost, but also like sometimes there's hunger that's going around here, and you're seeing, you know, big game animals walk around that you can't eat, and so Yeah, it was difficult. I know it's more complicated than that. And I know that there's, you know, there's a lot of different things and we want to conserve natural resources in Africa. I'm all behind that, but it was just personally hard to see that and to talk to people whose, you know, parents and grandparents, were able to go hunt a little bit and now they can't. So.
And in essence, the money that's raised from these expensive tags from non-residents fund their conservation over there.
Yeah, which is pretty successful. I mean, it's not the North American model, so it's not, you know, that everything is kind of cordoned off into these big parks, but you know, Serengeti National Park there is massive and there's great intact ecosystems that are really, you know, I don't know if they'd be there without the way that they're running things because they need resources to do it. But yeah, there was success, but also that it just hurt my soul a little bit when I was hearing from people who couldn't hunt when they wanted to and had the same traditions, you know, of like going out with grandparents and that kind of thing. And then it just gets cut off at some point.
Did you ask them how long this has been in place out there?
So it's been in place for a long time, but it seems like enforcement has stepped up in the region that I was in. I can't speak to the whole country, but in the region that I was in, it seemed like enforcement had stepped up over time. So the laws have been on the books, but people have still been able to go sneak out and do these different things. Right. And then that was that. And then the one thing that I learned there too, is that, being a hunter, like a so almost like a professional hunter, was like a designation within some of the villages there. And some people still have that designation. So when hyenas come into the village, that's the first guy they're calling to come and take care of that. And then he can get a, you know, a depredation permit type of a thing. And that's okay. He just doesn't get in trouble. But he can't hunt big game anymore for consumption. He can only do the depredation work.
How do hunters over there, let's say that guide or that person that gets the phone call, how do they rank in the community? You know, like here, doctors are very highly ranked and, you know, you can go down the list. Where does a hunter rank in that list over there?
I didn't get a real good sense for that, like in terms of where it ranked as opposed to other things, but it was a respected type of thing. And it, even more so because it seemed like, a lot of that in-depth knowledge wasn't there what more widely in the community anymore. And so it was kind of like it was just an expertise that wasn't really widely shared. So yeah, it was cool. But even then, even though it was like an official thing, it was kind of like hushed tones. Like, let's not talk too much about this, you know?
Man, that's so sad. Especially my wife and I have really been talking about this a lot lately. And I think this has kind of come up a lot over the last few weeks with some of my guests. It just, the connection that we have to the land and to the wildlife, when you go through the process to hunt, you understand the land. You understand everything needed for that animal or bird to survive on that landscape. And then when you harvest it, there is such a profound respect for that meat. You know, if my kids don't eat every cut of meat on the plate, which they almost always do, they're meat eaters and love it. If there's a little piece left, it would break my heart to see it go in the garbage can.
Right.
Because I just, I want every piece of that harvested food to be used and consumed and not wasted. And you just don't have a connection a lot of times with meat that you buy at the store or now that shows up on your front step.
Yeah.
You know, and people order online and it gets dropped off. And so it's not that big of a deal to toss a piece of it because you have no connection to it.
No.
You know, and you don't realize that you had to take a life in order to consume that. And that's the power that comes with hunting and understanding all of it. And the more we get taken away from that hunt, the less connection we have to the land and the animals and the creatures that live on it, which is just depressing in so many ways. Do you want to be a better shot in the field? Of course you do. We all do. Hi-Viz Shooting Systems has their sights set on helping you get there. See what I did there? Hi-Viz leads the shooting industry in sight upgrades for shotguns, handguns, and rifles. They're the chosen sight for major shotgun manufacturers and the number one choice for most of America's top competitive shooters for a reason. They have a wide variety of sights that help you see, aim, and hit your targets. Their Hi-Viz Birdbuster sight is a favorite one-size-fits-all shotgun sight built for us bird hunters. They also have Magna Optic technology for shotgunners dealing with cross-eye dominance. They have a Tri-Viz sight, which is one of the coolest turkey sights on the planet. These are just a few of the many sights they manufacture. The bottom line here is that you can depend on their innovative, bright, and durable sights when it matters most. Shoot better, shoot with confidence, shoot high-vis. Learn more at highvissights.com. Now is a great time to make the most of all that tasty meat you harvested. Maybe it's time to try a new recipe, sprinkle on a new seasoning, or make your own jerky and sausage. Trust me, it's not that hard to do, and it can be fun for the whole family. It doesn't matter what you harvested or what you want to prepare with it. Walton's has you covered. Walton's has everything but the meat. That's their motto. Walton's.com has everything, and I mean everything you need to process and prepare your meat. Plus, they have an online community called Meatgistics that's full of recipes and meat processing information. The sky's the limit, my friends. You don't have to be a pro to cook like one. Head to Walton's.com today and enjoy meat processing season. Thankfully, it's a season that never ends.
Flush Nation, are you tired of lugging your shotgun through the fields, feeling the strain on your back and shoulders? Well, no more. Introducing Ready Rest, the ultimate shotgun rest designed for hunters like you. Ready Rest is a game changer that lets you carry your shotgun effortlessly for hours without fatigue setting in. Ready Rest lets you go longer and put on more boot miles. Whether you're a seasoned hunter or a beginner just starting out, Ready Rest is perfect for anyone who wants a little extra support in the field. If you've ever experienced arm, shoulder, or back pain while carrying your shotgun, Ready Rest is your solution. Ready Rest keeps your shotgun safely pointed up, ready to shoulder. It's the ideal companion for those long days in the field, giving you confidence to go the distance without tiring. Get Ready Rest now and take your hunting experience to the next level. Visit ReadyRest.com to grab your Ready Rest today, because everybody deserves a break.
Let's maybe just transition right into what you guys are doing then. I didn't mean to get philosophical or maybe that's not even, Brandon, was that philosophical? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Hunters for Access. What is it? When did it begin? And what are you guys doing for the organization? Let's start with you, Adam.
So what, it started about 6 months ago?
Minnesota chapter. Yeah. Started about 6 months ago. And the whole organization is about 3 years old now. So very new effort here.
Evan's more of, he's been in it a lot longer. I'm here for more moral support than anything
oh,
else.
Okay. Well then Evan, tell us more.
Yeah. So it came out of this idea that kind of came up about, crowding and access to land being a really big issue across the whole, you know, kind of country. There's a lot of, you can talk about why that's the case. You can talk about, like, you know, X, Y, and Z, but in the end, everybody can agree that if we have more publicly accessible hunting land, everybody's going to be happier. Right.
Yeah.
And that has traditionally taken the tack of sort of, you know, the government's going to be doing their own thing with block management programs, or in Minnesota, we have walk-in access. And so really all we can do is just try our best to find properties and transfer them into, you know, the Department of Natural Resources. And the idea behind this really started in Montana was, why not both? If we can encourage and grow walk-in access programs, block management programs, things like that, and help people stay in those programs, that's just as good as if we can find, you know, like we have in Minnesota, this potlatch land that we want to transfer over to the DNR, right? So we're just going to go at it with both barrels and try and help that to move forward. And we're going to put more resources into that system. So it means we got to work really closely with both the Nature Fund, Nature Conservancy, and, you know, the DNR to be able to have those things work out. And the goal is expanding public access by any means. So public access for hunting by any means. And that can, any opportunity that we have to do that, we'll triage it and we'll see where we can go. But number one thing is that, you know, a lot of people were telling me, we don't need this in Minnesota at first, because they said, we got plenty of public land up north. But you know, the more you talk to people, that's not the experience for everybody. And I'm sure there's people saying, who would say that? But there's kind of two camps that I'm hearing, but in any event, I think everybody can agree that if we have more access, it's a good thing. Right.
Yeah.
And so the two tacks that we're kind of moving on now are, to help the Nature Fund, Nature Conservancy, to move some of those lands that they have in conservation in Potlatch Land Company land. You ever guys ever gone over that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, we haven't discussed it on this show. I'm familiar with it. Maybe you could give an overview. What is Potlatch land?
So there was a Potlatch Timber Company that owned these vast tracts of land, and then they would lease them out for, they'd have plantations, pine plantations on them. They'd lease them out for hunting. That's great, you know. They got out of the market and they transferred much of that land into I think the Nature Fund and the Nature Conservancy both have some of it. And the goal for both of those folks is not to manage those lands forever, because you can imagine that that's very pricey to both pay the property taxes and manage the land, you know, in a responsible way.
Just so people understand, it's huge. It's a lot of land. So can you give us a number?
I know one tract that they're trying to transfer over, one contiguous tract, is 12,000 acres. And so I don't know what the total is, but it's very large amount of land. There's some kind of like kinks in the system where, you know, they have to properly survey that. There's landowner kind of neighbor access issues that they have to get through. And then there's preparing the land for transfer. So from what I understand, and I don't want to speak for them, but from what I understand, like, the DNR doesn't want to take just a raw piece of property where there could be an old structure, there could be old deer stands, there could be, you know, widowmaker deadfalls hanging all around, and there's not like a parking space. It's just difficult for them to take that on. And
they also are hesitant to take on properties that aren't already adjoining current public land, WMAs or you know, scientific, areas.
I would say take it if you can use it and open it up. Like, the public would want that.
So
parcel.
there was a track in Northwest Minnesota. It was like 400 some acres. It was already enrolled in the WIP program. So there's already an easement on it, prime sharptail area, a bunch of sharptails on it. And I spent a month trying to call and talk to people to figure out just what the process is to get that over into public hands. And it was just roadblock after roadblock.
Sure.
And it's not necessarily that the DNR is not doing their jobs. I very well could have just not connected with the right people.
Yeah.
But as a single guy working a 9-to-5 in the same hours that all these other people are working, it's also really hard to connect with people.
Sure.
During that process, I kind of realized, like, I get why this is kind of an older generation. You know, the people that are doing this are generally in their retirement years, because it's almost a full-time job in itself, just trying to keep up with everything, contacting people and just trying to, you know, get things moving.
So are you guys trying to become a support system?
That's
essentially
right.
Correct.
Yeah.
For all these properties that aren't being managed right now.
Yeah. Well, they're being managed. That's the thing. So I've talked to Emily from the Nature Fund. She has to go out there every year and survey them and do at least some sort of management on them. And so what we want to do is really just, we're an entirely volunteer run organization. 100% of the money that we raise goes into this. And so what we'd like to do is just any way that we can provide to be kind of like the lubricant in the gears of the engine to just help smooth that process to get these things open into public lands and public hands rather. And so that might be that we just got some liability insurance. We'll go out there and we'll cut, you know, widowmaker deadfalls. We'll take down some old deer stands. We'll just make it easier for those things to happen. And the thing that's really critical for people to know about this is that there's a timeline attached to this, because these different nonprofit organizations that took over this Potlatch land, they can't keep it forever. They can't afford to keep it forever, right? And so they need to sell it off to the DNR within a certain amount of time. I think they had a 10-year process, and we're 7 years in. I don't want to, maybe she'd be a great guest too to talk about it more. But it's not like we can just wait forever and have this happen. They need more resources to make it happen within the time frame that they needed to happen. And so we said, well, why don't we, if we can help out at all with that, you know, it's volunteer time, and that's what it takes. It's not raising $1 million. It's the land's already there. It's already purchased. It's just the volunteer time to prepare it, to get it in, to be a wildlife management area, or whatever they want to manage it as. Right. And so, that'd be, you know, just a great kind of cost-effective way to get more acres into public hands.
Okay. So bigger picture, you guys started the Minnesota chapter.
Right.
How long ago? Six months
ago. Yeah.
Okay. And this all began in Montana.
That's right.
Okay. And now you have a chapter in Minnesota. You have a chapter in Montana. You have a chapter in Kansas.
That's Kansas, right. Colorado, I think it's starting. Colorado Wisconsin is coming up also.
Yep. And then Virginia is the next one that's kind of officially going to be recognized. So they've already kind of moved it forward.
Did they find you or did you find them?
It was kind of both. So we worked a little bit on the Montana chapter, just kind of learning a little bit about it. And they have a different, every state is unique. That's why it's so important that we have chapters in each state, is because like the block management program there is really, it's robust. And it's
in Montana.
In Montana. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody knows what block management is. There's resources being put into it, but, and there's some issues that they have that are unique. Right. And if we tried to use that plug and play here in Minnesota, I mean, it's just not the same at all. Like our walk-in access program, the DNR has now, they assign a full-time staff person to that, which is great. So they're putting more resources behind it. And it's a really great program for what we can invest in it. The DNR has done a wonderful job with it. But it's not, I mean, you compare that to block management and it's just, it's not the same at all. Right. So every state really needs to be able to have their own, advocacy and movement on it, or it just won't make sense. You can't take what you do in Montana and apply it to Virginia or Minnesota.
We also don't have the leasing issues that are in the West right now. So there's, I mean, I'm not from Montana, but there's plenty of stories of, oh, we used to be able to hunt this place, this ranch, or, you know, BML land, whatever, and now it's getting leased out.
BLM.
So, yep.
So, and that's for hunting or for cattle grazing when they lease it?
The BLM land is probably not getting leased out to hunters, but the ranchers and a lot of other local mm-hmm. areas that these guys used to hunt a lot in. Has been getting leased up.
So let's let people kind of wrap their heads around a little bit of why does somebody who owns their own property open it up so you and I and anybody else that feels like it can go hunt it? Why would they ever do that?
Because they're great people. That's number one.
I agree. They're wonderful people.
Most of the people who are doing this are folks who want to give back in some way. They do get walk-in access in Minnesota. I'll only speak to Minnesota. Does provide some additional funds per acre. So if you're enrolling your land in CRP and you can also do a walk-in access program, it helps you a little bit financially. But everybody that I've talked to, all the landowners that I've talked to, they're doing it for something bigger. They're doing it because they want to provide public access. And when they see kids especially go out learning to hunt on their land, like that's, they're so happy about it. Like that's what they want to see. Yeah. Right. And so they might not be the biggest hunters themselves. It might be to help, you know, grandma a little bit in retirement, cause she owns just like your farm. She owns the property and she needs a little bit more per acre, but in reality it's a headache, right? People are dropping trash. Not everybody is the best steward of their own land. Right. Mm-hmm. So people are dropping trash. Sometimes people cut fences. Sometimes there's different things that happen. And the reason that they're doing it most of the time is not just for this financial transaction. It's because they agree with all of us that we want to keep the tradition alive. They want to keep hunting going, and it makes them feel good to be able to do it, you know?
Yeah. And there is a financial aspect of it. So we're talking Minnesota here.
Yeah.
There's when you buy a license, you can say, I would like to donate to walk-in access.
Yeah.
If you don't, then you can't hunt those properties, correct?
Yep, that's right. And what I would say to people is even the way that you should think about this is that the walk-in access program in Minnesota is going to grow at some point. So even if you're not in Western Minnesota, where a lot of those walk-in access areas are, if you buy that access just to grow the program, you know, maybe someday the farm next to you will have walk-in access. And so it's a chicken and the egg thing, right? If you can get the funds to start growing what they're doing there, it'll benefit you in the end, and it'll benefit your fellow hunters. So it's a good program to support.
Absolutely. I have a friend many years ago, and I've kind of tried to adopt this too. When he got old enough to buy licenses or had to buy them legally, he would buy every one of them. And there weren't all these, walk-in access didn't exist back then. I mean, this was over 25 years ago when he started doing this, but I was like, why are you buying a trout stamp? You don't trout fish. He goes, yeah, well, if I can put a couple dollars into helping the trout resource, I'm happy with that. And then he didn't pheasant it, but he bought a pheasant stamp. Same reason. All these dollars go towards it. I was like, that's really something that I can get behind too. You know, the fact that I can go and harvest a deer for, I don't know, what is the license now, $32 or something like that in this state here as a resident. and have that many meals off of it, or I buy a fishing license and I can fish 365 days a year for what is it, $28? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's not something where I'm not upset that I have to pay that license fee. I think most hunters and anglers would agree. Now they're going to say, no, they're raising the rates and, you know, and they shouldn't raise the rates. And, but if they, if the dollars that we're putting into the resource returns, that's important. It's important to know that, right?
Yeah.
When you look at the walk-in access here in our state, we'll get into other states if you want, but what does that even equate to when you look at how many people actually pay for that extra little stamp? And is it enough to fund it? Is it growing?
Yeah, I know that it's growing. Talking to folks in the DNR, I haven't looked at like their internal books or anything on it, but I know that they've also invested in it. So they used to have a part-time person who was just sort of, you know, helping where they could, but they had other job responsibilities. And now there's one person who is the walk-in access coordinator. So if you just think about like organizational momentum and management, that's a big thing for people to have invested in. And so I know that it's growing and they see the value of it for sure. The other thing is that the walk-in access programs just writ large, they don't require a permanent dilution of like the tax base in any county that they're in because they're not transmitting this land into public hands. And that's the only thing that is difficult sometimes with public ownership of land is that, you know, your tax base is decreasing. With the walk-in access program, that you know can continue and you can still maintain your tax base. And if there ever comes a time where they need to change it back over to crop production, they sure could. I mean, most people aren't going to do that in walk-in access, but they could, you know. And
it depends on the contract, the length of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
yeah.
How we as hunters treat that land and that landowner.
And that's the key here is that the other part of this is just like, you know, if we've already organized a bunch of volunteer events to go out to these different walk-in access areas and just do little things like clean up trash or, you know, mend fences. It's just to make it so that it's easier for people to stay in that program, right?
Do you knock on the farmer's door and say, Always. Hi, we're from this organization. We thank you for what you're doing here and we want to help. Are you okay if we walk out on your property and Always. Help keep it clean?
Yeah.
What do they say then?
They're always pretty touched. Honestly, they're happy to do it. I've never had anybody say no to it. I mean, they're already in the spirit of giving public access, right? Yeah. And unfortunately, sometimes when I do that, I hear you know, some stories about people. Well, you know, somebody came in here and then it was a little bit muddy in the field, and I told them not to park here, and then they, you know, tore ruts up. And so, you know, we have these conversations with people about like, what is it that might push you out of allowing this access, right? Okay, how can we potentially solve some of those issues and just bringing awareness to it. So like talking to your fellow outdoorsmen, outdoors women, talking to people about, you know, how you can be low impact on the land and thank these folks is going to do a lot to keep them in the program. And it's just these little things of like, I want to keep it open, but you know, this area keeps getting rutted up, or, you know, people keep tossing plastic water bottles out and then they get into my goat's pen was one person's problem, you know? And it's like, how much would it really take to just stop doing that and to be aware of it so that then you can keep access to this land and potentially grow it?
I just can't wrap my head around somebody that throws garbage out.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
I just can't wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even know what to say to that. You know, that there's an issue that people leave their trash around and it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I get that sometimes things blow out of the back of the vehicle and you didn't realize it happened.
Sure.
But the amount of garbage that gets thrown around is not all accidental.
No.
And to be able to know that people are out there just doing it without thinking twice.
Yeah.
Blows my mind. And I could see as a landowner saying, you guys, I'm done with this. This is ridiculous.
It's those little things that, you know, deter them from the program, in our opinion.
Right.
And that's part of our mission is to help connect with these landowners and try to give an added value that they weren't anticipating. They're not asking for, but the people that are using the land are giving them that added value.
Yeah. And honestly, I think the most effective thing that we do is to just knock on the door and say, thank you. Like they're a lot of times they're kind of disconnected from, I mean, they can look out the window and they can see the kids hunting and that makes them feel good. Almost all of them will say something like that. You know, like we watched this happen this year. It was great. But a lot of times people aren't, you know, giving that positive feedback to say, thank you. Anything else that we do, I think is kind of icing on the cake to letting these people know that we appreciate what they're doing. We see what they're doing and we're willing to do what we can to help it make it be an easy process for them.
So then my question is, how do you get volunteers to join you out there to go clean up and do this work?
A great question. If you go to huntersforaccess.org and you go to the sign up page, if you put your home state as Minnesota, it'll automatically come to us. So you'll get a nice welcome email, personal email from me. We're all volunteers. Sometimes you might have to wait a couple of weeks. It's hard to keep up with, but you'll always get that. And then we can hook you into the whole process and what we're doing there. So it's automatic. If you're in Minnesota, you can do that. If you're not in Minnesota, I know your audience is a little bit wider than just Minnesota. We don't currently have existing chapters in like North Dakota, Iowa, or Wisconsin. So if you wanted to, you could join up with the Minnesota chapter to start, and we can help you with the process to get something started in your own state. But like I said, it doesn't really make sense for us to run things for Wisconsin from Minnesota. It's a totally different ballgame.
So you're waiting for somebody like you to step up and say, I'll lead this chapter here in our state.
Yeah.
Why did you guys raise your hand to do this? Wait, actually, what are your roles? You guys, are you like president and vice president?
Yeah.
He's the president. Yeah. I just kind of got wrapped in and I think I'm
You're
on
just the
board
arm
right
candy
now.
Over
yeah.
there.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm the grunt.
Yeah, I'm the interim.
Mule.
Yeah.
Everyone needs a good mule. Yeah.
That's right. And we've got a few. And so I'm the interim president actually, because we're still forming the legal documentation. We're operating under our national charter right now, but we'll have our own nonprofit in Minnesota. And then at that point we'll have elections. It's going to be completely, you know, it's democratic. People can choose who's going to be the president, and it's again entirely volunteer. So nobody who's doing this is making any money off the process. It's 100% of what we're doing goes into the mission. The problem is that makes it difficult to run. I mean, like I said, I was in Tanzania for 3 weeks. Nobody got an email back during that time. You know, we're all working 9 to 5s or longer than that. But what that means is that there's no egos involved. Nobody's getting rich. Nobody's doing anything off it. It's just really a pure mission to move.
I gotta ask, do you guys think this is sustainable?
I think it is, because it's just a community-based effort to go out and volunteer and do things. And it doesn't really require a huge amount of centralization and leadership, because it can just say, you know, we have to have training for the liability insurance. We can organize chapters to go out. And really all that they're doing is cleaning places or going out and helping people, making connections between hunters and landowners, that kind of thing. And so I think it's not like the more we grow necessarily, it's going to be a exponential sort of growth of responsibilities and the management aspect. I think there's a lot that can be taken on through this kind of volunteer model.
If you're an active outdoorsman or woman on the go, then odds are good that you have toys and equipment that you need to haul. Well, our friends at Aluma Trailers, they've got you covered. Their trailers are built by a hardworking team in Bancroft, Iowa, right here in the good old USA. They have models for all of your hauling needs, from ATV and UTV trailers to utility, snowmobile, motorcycle, car trailers, and even fully enclosed trailers like mine. Trust me when I say that Aluma Trailers tow gear like a dream. Their trailers are constructed out of lightweight, strong, corrosion-resistant aluminum, and they are 100% maintenance-free. Plus, they come with an industry-best 5-year warranty. Visit AlumaKLM.com to find a trailer that fits your needs. OnX Hunt continues to update their hunt app with features that will make you a better hunter. Their app shows you exactly where you stand on planet Earth, and it shows the property boundaries for every single public and private parcel. That's a big deal when you're on the hunt following a bird dog in wild places. Their app also has updated 3D mapping, shows land topography, wind, weather, local hunting regulations, and has tools to help you make smart decisions while in the field. They have layers that show you the kind of crops farmers have planted in the fields, the kind of trees growing in forests, and when those forests were logged or burned. These are details that matter when you hunt birds. Their app now has updated satellite images, so you can even see what's happening on your favorite properties within the past 2 weeks. You can use the Onyx Hunt app with Apple CarPlay right in the dash of your hunting rig. The same layers that show up on your phone appear right on the dash of your truck. There's a reason Onyx is the number one GPS hunting app, trusted by millions of hunters. I firmly believe they've built one of the best hunting tools available today. And they give back to our favorite habitat organizations to create more wild places that are open to hunters like you and I. Always know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If there's one thing that we live for here at The Flush, it's bird hunting. And we all know that you can't have good bird hunting without good habitat. Few people know more about bird habitat than Hoxie Native Seeds. Family-owned and operated, Hoxie Native Seeds has provided bird hunters across the Midwest with countless acres of premium native habitat mixes sourced straight from their own fields in the heart of Iowa. Perennial food plots, quail mixes, pheasant mixes, CRP, even dog-friendly seed mixes. To learn more, go to HoxieNativeSeeds.com. That's H-O-K-S-E-Y NativeSeeds.com. To order your own premium hunting habitat mixes today. So I had somebody from the Kansas chapter reach out to me wanting to say, hey, we're doing this fundraiser and wondering if you can help us get the word out. I was like, funny you should say this because I have some people from the Minnesota chapter coming in.
Great.
And they were doing this when you were in Tanzania. So I just was like, well, I'll just wait and have the conversation when you get back. Because I'm guessing it's a national fundraising event going on right now. What is it and how does it work?
So it's a raffle that's online and it is run through our national branch. And then those funds are going to be split for all of the currently opening chapters. So this will be the first big chunk of money that can come to Minnesota to help us run things and do different things that we need to do with the money and pay for liability insurance. That's a big thing, right? So it's going to be, if you go on to huntersforaccess.org, you click on the raffle button, there's a lot of good stuff there, but you can.
Brandon, can you go to huntersforaccess.org and tell us what's on there when you have a minute?
All those things, you can buy individual, you don't have to buy a ticket for something you don't want. So you can buy individual tickets for every individual thing. And then a third of that money is going to come back to Minnesota to help out to grow our chapter, our nascent chapter here.
What if I wanted to go to Kansas?
Then donate there and you can have the three. Yeah. There's also individual donate links for Kansas and for Montana Hunters for Access organizations there. We don't have one yet because we don't have our own 501c3 yet, but we'll still get under the umbrella of the organizations, we'll still get a third of it.
And the point of that is to help the new chapters grow, right? So, once the Minnesota chapter gets established, we can start having our own raffles and be a very Minnesota-centric fundraiser. Sure.
Brandon, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
What did we see in there? What could I win today?
What could you win? I mean, there's a lot of things that you can win. So we've got everything from there's a day-long range course, equipment provided, there's a mystery ranch, there's so much stuff, it's hard to actually like focus on one thing, believe it or not. There's some optics on there that you can get on there. There's a vault for your guns. There's, I see a little bit more optics on there.
There's a pack raft and a six-person teepee, I think. Yeah.
There's an archery bundle on there. There's a Garmin bundle and everything, too. A
couple nice knives,
GPS tracker,
too.
Yeah.
So this is not just upland related. I mean, our listeners are upland hunters, but a lot of them probably hunt big game as well. So there's
even a Walton's 11-pound sausage stuffer. Too. So right, I mean, there's something for everybody.
There's a Garmin dog collar on there too.
Yep. Sitka women's bundle as well. Yeah. So yeah, there's something for everybody.
We're trying to make it nationally appealing.
Right. Yeah. No, I get that. And obviously, if somebody bids on it, and you get these items that are available, the money then we know is going back into what I mentioned at the very start of the show. The largest challenge hunters face today is accessing good hunting land. If we're being honest, that's one of the biggest things that prevent, when I have conversations outside of this circle that I'm in, right here today, and all these people I work with and I'm out on the road, buddies of mine, at let's say a church or something like that, and I bring up, you guys going turkey hunting? They're like, well, I want to, but I don't really know where I can go. I hunted this this public spot last year, and you know, the birds just got pushed off of it, and I was hunting the fourth season. It's just what my schedule allowed, and I didn't have luck. And so the reality is that, you know, the amount of public land is pretty limited in this area. And so if he could get permission on the private land, then his chances probably go up a little bit, but not everybody gets that access. And then therefore, is he going to go?
Yep.
I don't know. I mean, that's just one example out of one conversation that I had yesterday.
Boy, when I go out west for pheasant, it's pretty pressured. There's, you know, the walk-in access areas I've actually had better luck in because there seems to be less people utilizing those. But there's, you know, you can see the hunter trails, so to speak, through those grasslands.
Right.
You go up northeast for grouse. And they're getting pushed around quite a bit too.
Yeah.
So we're lucky that we have the amount of public land that we have.
It's true.
But it is getting utilized.
Right. All the more reason to make very well known to the people that are raising their hand and opening up this land and saying that we can say thank you.
Exactly.
And do something.
And for me, you know, I'm not bankrolling a bunch of stuff. I don't have the money to bankroll a bunch of stuff.
Same.
I do have some extra time on the weekend and I'm capable of physical work.
Yeah.
I would much rather do
How rewarding is it though when you're out there?
That's
the best.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been my biggest gripe with these bigger organizations. Not that they're not doing good stuff, because they definitely are.
Yeah.
But I wish there was more boots on the ground stuff. Yeah. For the local guys to get involved and say, we care about this. We want to improve this. We want to make this better.
Just recently, and I mentioned this on the last week's episode, my family came with and we did a hands-on habitat day with our local Pheasants Forever chapter.
That's awesome.
It's awesome. Yeah. It's so much fun. The kids were hands-on. They were hauling buckthorn after I cut it down and pulling it out. And I just think, we talked about what this land was before we got there and how it's changed. And now they're trying to restore it in a couple of years when they go back and see what their hard work has turned into, along with everyone else in this community. One, they're connected now with a lot of other people, because when you work together, just like when you hunt together, you're connected. You share a bond with something that's pretty powerful. And that is established. Everybody that left that day is like, hey, if you need anything else, let me know. Yep. I'm like, my chainsaw is always ready to go. Right. If you need me, let me know. I'll bring a trailer.
Those are the people we're hoping are going to come to this program or, you know, Hunters for Access.
Yeah.
Those are the guys that we're really targeting. You know, come help us help public land and help the private landowners that are willing to open it up to us. Because without them, we're really not getting much bigger.
What do you guys have coming up then? I got to ask.
Yeah, so we're really waiting for this fundraiser to be complete so we can kind of have a strategic plan in place to know what's going on. We will have some little events. You can go to the website and see little sign-up events that we can do throughout time. But once we know kind of like how this has gone, then we'll have the resources to dedicate to where we're going to focus in the state, right? And we'll kind of have a map of how we can do that. Because as you said, It isn't like we can just slowly throw the switch as a volunteer all or only organization and just do everything everywhere. So we're gonna figure out where we have volunteers, where people are signing up, and what funds we have to organize and manage that. And then that'll be a concerted effort going into the fall, going into hunting season. So this fundraiser will wrap up on June 1st. And then after that, we'll have all that planning session in place. We'll know what to go with for there. But if you want more information, signing up for that mailing list and signing up on the website will get you what you need there. So huntersforaccess.org.
What do you guys need right now?
I think doing this podcast is more than enough in our opinion from you. Okay. You know,
what if somebody listening then says
volunteer? Yeah. Come help us.
Do that sign up. If anybody has access or knowledge with the soil and water conservation districts in Minnesota, we have a couple folks on our board that are from those different districts, but we don't have a reach in the entirety of the state. And so if you work for or you know really well the soil and water conservation districts, we want to talk to you. If you have a forestry background or if you have a background in land management, anything like that, we want to talk to you too. It's going to be helpful. And it helps. I mentioned liability insurance a few times, but you can imagine that as a small nonprofit working with chainsaws, that gets pricey. And so if we have people who have that forestry background, it helps out a lot with that. It helps make people calm and understand. And
can I show up with my chainsaw?
Absolutely, yeah. But here's the process, though. You have to sign up.
I had to sign a waiver on the last time.
Yeah, right. And you'll have to sign up on the website so we know that you're coming. We can get the waiver and all that stuff, because that's the key. Is we can't just have people show up and not be covered by the insurance, you know,
right?
Boring
well,
stuff, but
and
important.
There's also too, because that's a public or that's a private property that
exactly.
You're accessing versus the public properties that we worked on, because that's through Minnesota
exactly.
lands, basically. Once the Pheasants Forever chapter buys it, they do the work, they, you know, partner with the state, it then goes into state hands. Now it's a wildlife management area, WMA, right. And the sign says WMA on it, which is interesting in a way that, you know, how it got to that point, this restoration of this massive complex that has grown over the last 20 years. And this is just the one piece that I'm speaking about
that I
live near, and it's near and dear to our heart to see what's happening there. It's a beautiful thing, but the process is extensive.
Yeah.
You know, and so I get all the behind the scenes things that you guys have to have there. And that's why I ask, you know, what do you need? What do you want? And then I you've already answered that. But my last question is, what are you afraid of right now?
The biggest
that's a hard one. You're laughing over
there.
Why don't you take it then?
Well, my biggest fear right now is I'm a big upland guy. My biggest fear right now.
Same here, and same to everybody listening.
Is Minnesota prairie chickens, and the sharp tail. So to me that's my passion. And
you're nervous about them?
Yeah.
Prairie chickens are so reliant upon private land too. You know, yeah. I mean,
that's in that region. There's very little public land. I mean, there's a few that the Cupido wildlife management area, that's a new one in that area, but that's also I believe the last area where we have remnant short grass prairies.
Yeah.
And to me, we're not going to get any more of those short grass prairies unless there's private landowners
raising their own hands.
Yep. And saying yes, we want to be part of this.
Well, you listened to the Prairie Farm podcast that we had a couple weeks ago, and they mentioned how it's once it's gone, it is almost impossible to get back.
Yep.
And we've already seen the sharptail in this state. There's certain parts of the state that still have sharptail grouse, and 2/3 of those like sections are not open to hunting anymore.
Nope. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's with the way the commodity prices are going, you know, corn, ethanol, stuff like that, there's direct correlation between a rise in commodity prices and a decrease in CRP.
Yep.
From my view, the walk-in access is a way to help mitigate that. And if we can help expand this program and show landowners that they are appreciated for doing this, that, you know, that's what I think we can help get us out of some of this.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, hunters have ruined a lot of things for other hunters over the years, and it's our responsibility to make things as great as we can to help everybody. Just, it doesn't matter if you're a part of this organization that you guys are launching, or you're just going out hunting, when you leave, stopping at the house and saying thank you so much, sharing the story, sharing the harvest, coming back later, thanking again, and go out of your way to show that appreciation. I go as so far out of my way, and I wish I could do more to thank the people that give us access. I'm taking 3 young kids out turkey hunting in the next few days here, and I have gotten permission from people that have said, yes, you can. And it means the world to me. When we knocked on doors, because there's not enough public access in our immediate area, public lands to take these kids. And I know there's other people, I shouldn't say there's not enough. I know there's going to be a lot of competition out there. And so I'm trying to provide the best experience possible.
Especially for kids. It's
for
important.
Kids, it is important. And adults that hadn't done it before. There's nothing more powerful than watching a Tom strutting in and gobbling his head off on the way in. Man. But if that doesn't exist, I don't know if they're going to stay. And maybe they will, maybe they won't. Different story. But I'm knocking on doors. And my son, Cash, he's like, Dad, we're 0-6. Because they kept track as we knocked on door. And I'm like, buddy, this is how you do it. It's not a guarantee. And everyone had the reasons why we were not able to go in. And then when we knocked on a door and they said, yeah, go ahead. They were just so pumped because we have a place to go on turkey opener that they get to hunt. And I would have figured something out. We would go hunt somewhere. But when somebody does say, yes, you can.
It almost makes that hunt more exciting because you got that permission.
Yeah.
If you get that yes, all of a sudden I'm more jacked up and I'm like, let's go.
You know? And I want to make sure the next person can get that yes.
Yeah.
And I want to leave it as best as I possibly can. That should be the mission for all of us. If you take something, how can you give back?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's such a good thing. If more people sort of writ large in you know, the hunting industry can talk about that more and say, hey, we should just have a culture of that. Thank you. We should have a culture of that. That appreciation and the developing relationships with the landowners that you're working with. I think that would be really helpful because it's one of the benefits of doing this is the relationships that you build both with your teammates and the different people that you're working with, but also with, landowners and other folks there. And I think that if we can normalize that more and we can get back to that, it's going to help everybody and it's going to feel better too.
So. Absolutely. And I know you're not doing it for this reason, but I will say this, when you go and get together with a group of people out there and you're working on the lands with other people, you're going to develop relationship with landowners and they might say, hey, you know what? I've got another 80 acre chunk over here too. Yeah. It's not enrolled, but I really appreciate what you guys are doing. You can hunt that if you need a place to go with your kid or something like that too. Yeah. You'd have no idea how that's going to come back around full circle, but when you serve other people, it always comes back around.
And, you know, we're also hoping that instead of, it'll be great if, hey, you can go hunt that. It's not open to the public. You can go hunt it. It'll be even better if he says, you know what? These guys actually care about what they're doing and appreciate what we have. I'm going to open up that
EDA. Yeah,
that's our goal. That's our goal. Yeah. We're really kind of worried about that too. In terms of stuff we're worried about, we want to make it clear. We have to have clear ethical guidelines around this, that it's like, we might have to say no to that access because we don't want people to feel like, well, if I do this, I'll get this little extra.
Yeah.
We want it to be open to the public. It's got to be. And there's a lot of rules like with the 501c3 regulations, like we can't have personal benefit. And it's good. We our goal is to advocate for public access to these things. If we have a relationship along the way, all those type of things, that's great. But our goal would be to use that relationship and convince people that it's worth it to open up that land to everybody. Yeah. And how can we do that? How can we make you, make you feel the love from your fellow hunters and see the generations of people coming through and maybe even, you know, share some postcards of harvest and that kind of thing as time goes on. And like, that's our goal. It's not to, it's to open up as many public acres to public access as we can and to make that process enjoyable and bearable for the landowners. That's what we're trying to do.
Love it. Gentlemen, any final parts? I think you just summed it up really well right there. So if you have anything to add, now's your time.
Thanks. I mean, it's been great chatting with you and getting to know you. And your dog's awesome too. So what a fun afternoon here.
Well, we have to go out and see if the Tom's showed up to the call now.
Yeah, let's go see.
We appreciate everybody listening today and all the feedback that we continue to get from everybody. Again, the website, one last time, for your organization is?
Huntersforaccess.org.
There you go. Opening in multiple states around the country, more coming, and obviously volunteers making this happen. Yep. So just remember that and raise your hand if you have the ability to do it. Yep. And let your cup be filled by the work that you do out there on the land.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Flush Podcast. Mm-hmm.